Evening and welcome to the fifth edition of the Profiles in Performance podcast. Really pleased to say that Hugh Taylor's agreed to join me this evening. Hugh Taylor, as just about everybody I think who's listening to this will know, is probably Britain's most successful publicly available tipster. Over the past decade, I think he's had profits of 200 points or more every single year, with perhaps one exception where I think it was 199 points. Most people know that Hugh's column has an impact on the markets in a way that no other tipster's column does. You'll often see prices halving within about 30 seconds of it going up. And I often think that the litmus test of just how good Hugh Taylor is that with most tipsters you'll see people complaining about bad runs or bad selections, but with Hugh it's generally the complaints are only ever about not being able to get on at advised prices, which in other words means Hugh's almost too good for his own good. So yeah, Hugh Taylor, thanks for coming on tonight.
Hello, Will. Hello, everybody. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
There's so many questions to get through. Do you just want to spend a minute for people who don't know talking about how you've got to where you are working for at the races and where your kind of interest in racing stemmed from?
Okay. When I was a kid, I was taken around lots of race courses in Yorkshire by a friend of the family who used to, we used to go and visit him at the weekend. My mum died when I was very young and they sort of took a bit of the weight off my dad. And on the weekends, so I was taken around York and Wetherby and Thirsk and Catterick and Ripon and all these places. And that's how I originally got interested in it. I kind of maintained that interest all the way through, really. And then my first career job took me to Lingfield. I was working in a residential unit, which was 5 minutes walk from the race course. So that certainly didn't harm with keeping me interested. And I worked there. I was in charge of one of the residential units there for 12 years. And racing was sort of my hobby. And I used to go there all the time. I applied for a job through an advertisement for Arena Online, which turned into the original At the Races Format 1. And I was given the job by a guy called David Stewart, who is a well-known person in horse racing. He was the original computer kid with the Sun many, many years ago. And the original At the Races folded after 3 or 4 years, and I was lucky then because I got offered the job to be Kerin McAvoy's agent. So I was Kerin's agent between 2004 and 2009, all the time that he was in England. That was great experience. I don't think I was a very good agent, but it actually worked out quite well with me and Kerin. We got on quite well, and I managed to muddle through, and so that was good. And then when he went back to Australia, I was offered the job that I'm doing now. So I've been the At the Races lead UK tipster for the last 10 years.
I want to basically jump straight into this because there's so much to get through. If listeners are taking notes, I was keen to split this into four different categories where basically we take you through basically a day in the life of Hugh, starting with the things he does prior to form study, then second, the form study process itself, and then his selection, his betting and tipping process, and then finally any kind of analysis he'll do of his work post-racing. And so your column will tend to go up around 9:30, and after that, is it a case of watching all the racing that goes on of an afternoon?
Okay, when I finish doing the column, the next couple of hours are usually to do with catching up in one way or another, either with speed figures or watching replays of races. And I probably watch... During the day, I've got either ATR or RUK on all the time. We're usually flipping backwards and forwards. And I only have one TV screen. I know most of the big pros have all these multiple screens, but I just have one. I can't be doing with more than one TV screen. But yeah, obviously I've got an eye on the racing during the day, but I tend to find it more fertile to look back through a meeting, because then you've got the whole, you've got everything, you've got all the times in front of you. You can look at the sectional times. You can... compare different distances. You can, you know, which races, how many races were in at a true tempo. So I find it more helpful to look back through a meeting at a time. So I tend to do that during the period after I've finished doing my column. As I say, if I'm doing some speed figures, that's when I'll do that as well. And then probably once I've got on towards lunchtime, that's when I'll start looking towards the next day's racing.
And you mentioned speed figures there. I think from reading your column, you certainly, in terms of your write-ups, you make reference to the clock, to sectional times, to notable sectional performances. Do you make use of time form? Do you accumulate your own speed figures? I mean, you mentioned there that you calculate them yourself. I mean, that's clearly, if you're collecting speed figures for every race or certainly a high number of races, that's a time-consuming process.
Yeah, it is. The answer is yes to both questions. Yes, I do use time form, but I do keep my own speed figures on the all weather, and I've done that for I don't know how many years now, quite a lot of years now. And I do a little bit of my own sectional times, and I use a little bit of time form's subscription sectional time service. So yeah, it's a bit of both. I've never, as you say, keeping your own speed figures is quite time-consuming, although when you've been doing it for a while, it doesn't take quite so long. I found that, you know, normally I can do a meeting in about 10 minutes now. Yeah. So it's a bit of a combination of both, really.
And your rationale, I take it, for collecting your own speed figures on all-weather tracks is, I take it, the uniformity of conditions there?
Yes, there's no rail movements on all weather tracks, which is one blessing. It is. When you say uniformity of conditions, you do get big variations in the way
going,
that the going variant, for sure, just as you do on turf tracks. But I've just found that speed figures. I originally found this out when I was doing tipping at Southall, because the one thing about Southall is that there's barely such a thing as a falsely run race. So it is, many people have said, in that respect, it's similar to American dirt racing. They tend to go a gallop from the start, and therefore you tend to get six truly run races on a six race card. And it then went on from, so Southall was actually where I started off doing my own speed ratings, and then carried on to do them for all the all-weather tracks. I've never done my own ones for the turf tracks just because of time. You know, that's the simple reason.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair enough. There was a question that Tony Keenan asked in relation to this, which is, he asked whether there are certain circumstances in which time figures are especially useful or especially dubious. And the comment he gave was just thinking of tracks that might throw up weird figures or ground where things go out the window. Are there conditions or a certain type of track or a certain type of race where you're more likely to rely on the clock, be it from time form or for your own speed figures?
Let me think. In terms of one part of the question was, are there any areas where I'm a bit wary of them? A couple of areas that come to mind. Firstly, amateur riders races. Yeah. This may be a reflection on my own. I use weight, and I weight my speed figures, and I always have done. And maybe it's because my framing of the weights when I do them is out. But I do find that amateur riders races can tend to throw up excessive figures that I just don't trust, and I always put a big question mark behind them. It also may be down to the possibility that the effect of weight isn't linear, that it may not have the same impact the further up, the higher up the weights you go. I'm not sure about that. I've never really done any research into it, but that's one area. The other kind of horse I'm a bit wary of when it's clocked a high figure in comparison to its rivals in the race is when there's been a really truly run race and a horse finishes fifth or sixth and is sort of been almost dragged into that fast time. And you're then thinking, because I just find that those horses, that's probably the absolute peak limit, and they're by no means guaranteed to get anywhere near that when there's a slightly, you know, a less strong pace. So I tend to be a bit, you know, I sometimes I'm a bit more wary of those.
And in terms of your actual, I mean, when it comes to your all-weather speed figures, do you have a methodology that would be similar to, say, how Timeform calculate it for you, look at the kind of pace of the race and perhaps give upgrades based on horses who have come from inopportune positions or horses who have perhaps been flattered by, say, benefiting from a pace bias? Is it these kind of things that you use to perhaps give upgrades to speed ratings that you calculate?
When I record them, I just record the raw figures. I'll work out my going variant, work out all the the different numbers, and I don't add anything on. But I will make a note in my in tracker or whatever, much better than the result. Blah blah blah. And I'll I might put what I thought the closing sectional was, or how much better I thought it was, that sort of thing. The figures I keep are just raw figures, and when I store them, I don't actually add to them. I do that as sort of part of the later process, if you like.
Yeah, and would that therefore suggest that they are, say, your all weather speed figures are only one kind of small element of a bigger form picture? Would you ever kind of bet, perhaps not solely, but predominantly because a horse has perhaps put up a notably big figure?
And I'd be more inclined to do so if it had put up two notably big figures that were, say, better than anything else in the field has done. But you're looking at the type of race. If it's a race where everything else is fairly exposed and you've got a horse that has come through and produced a figure that you're fairly confident is kosher and legitimate and it's significantly quicker, and you're also confident that nothing else in the field has run that fast, and you're happy with everything else. So you are, even then, you're taking into account other things like the draw and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's not just a case of looking at the figures. It's quite often my starting point with the all weather, because you can rule, there's a lot of horses that have run at least half a dozen times on the all weather, and you know they've not run a fast enough figure, and there's no obvious reason why they're going to run a fast enough figure today, and you can put a line through them straight away. So it's a very good starting point. That would be the way I'd put it.
And I think, and I'm not 100% certain on this, but I can vaguely recall you making mention of keeping a kind of Nag Me or a horse alerts page where you keep a record of, I don't know, is it certain eye catchers that you would keep a record for, or is it perhaps horses you've previously tipped up?
Not so much horses I've previously tipped up. Once I've selected them, I'd want another good reason to be selecting them again, obviously if they were unlucky or something like that. But no, it's tends to be, I'm not sure eye catchers are the right term anymore, because when I think of eye catchers, I think of things that everybody's probably seen. It's things that where a horse has been better than the result. Yeah. And the more likely I am to think there's a chance that it might not be impacting in the market next time, the more likely I am to put them in my horse alerts. And I put a lot in, to the extent that in the summer I'm probably getting at least 30 a day.
So that that really is why. So it's, yeah. So you'll be getting big emails. And I mean, in terms of your actual process for going, do you go through every, so say you, I don't know, you, I assume you use At The Races service. Do you kind of go through every horse that's come through in your email when you receive it?
Yeah, you get the email through, and because you've got the horse's name and you've got your write-up as well. I'm terrible at remembering horses' names, but as soon as I see the write-up, I can remember the race instantly. It's, I can't remember names, but I'm quite good at remembering what's actually happened in races. And you then have a quick look at what race they're in. Sometimes they're ones where you know instinctively that you've put it in your horse alerts, but everybody else will have done as well, and you know it's not going to be a bet because it's going to be factored into the market. Then you're also looking at, are the conditions right? Sometimes I'll have put in the alerts, one to be interested if it's back on the all weather, or one to be interested if he's upping trip, something like that. So you go through them, and that's not really that long a process, but it does prompt you to look at each race that the horse is involved in on your email. And that's generally the starting point of the day for me.
Okay. And so at that point, I mean, and I guess this kind of brings us more into the actual form study process here, because they kind of overlap. If you've had a horse that's come through, will you look at the race it's in with the prices up? I mean, do you, when you're approaching a race generally, are you looking at it blind, or are you happy to that you're at a stage now where the prices in a race don't really factor your thinking?
If by blind do you mean do I look at the prices before?
Yeah.
Beforehand, no, I don't. I look at the race and try and avoid, where at all possible, looking at the prices. That said, I'm much less likely to actually fully price up a race these days than perhaps many years ago. I used to do a lot of my own tissues and pricing up races, and I still think that's an absolutely rock solid way of approaching a race, providing you're confident that you're able to assess all the important variables that can contribute to a race. The reason I don't do it anymore is that I'm reasonably confident in my ability to look at a race and judge what price the horse I'm interested should be, and what would be value and what won't, without going through. And it sounds a bit, it's not something I'd really recommend. It's a bit like when you're driving, you learn bad habits and you just go on through doing it. It's not a particularly good habit to have. But in terms of the time that's available to me each day, I think it's a more logical use of time, and then that frees me up to spend more time looking at other races.
Yeah. So it's almost muscle memory, that you've done it often enough that it's kind of almost like an instinctive feel for what's the correct price, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm just taking out the mechanical aspect of it. I'm looking down a race, and, you know, if it's a 10-runner race, I might be thinking, I might instantly have, right, well, those five are all 25-plus, 33-to-1-plus chances. I think that's probably the right favourite. And you know, the horse I'm looking at, I might be thinking, well, it should probably be a 6-to-1 chance. Let's hope it's 10-to-1, let's hope it's 12-to-1, something like that, you know, and then after that, once I've got the general idea of what price I think is okay, only then will I actually start looking at the prices. I mean, of course, I'm doing this the day before anyway, so there probably won't be any actual prices available at that time, but there might be betting forecasts and stuff like that.
Sure. I noticed on the FAQ section on your tips column that the kind of value cutoff point you see is around the 77-78% mark of the price that you're putting the horse up at. Are you therefore looking for perhaps particularly good value in a way that is perhaps not as necessary for less high profile tipsters?
That's a good point you've raised, actually. The FAQ badly needs updating. That's many years old now. And it's funny enough, I was speaking to my boss the other day about, I'm intending rewriting that completely, because it is very out of date. I would say, for one thing, I'd probably say be aiming at a fair bit lower than the 0.77, 0.78. That you've mentioned there, and that it says in the FAQ at the moment. Other than that, it's very difficult. I mean, all I can really do is try and highlight horses that I think are overpriced, and I don't always know which way they're going to go in the market afterwards. So I'm obviously doing my best. If I'm tipping a horse at 25-to-1, as I did today, you can be fairly sure that I don't believe it's a 20-to-1 shot. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't tip a horse just because it was 25-to-1 rather than 20-to-1. So I am looking, I'm trying to find as much margin as I can, because I do know that people aren't going to be able to always get the top prices, or even close to the top prices. And that's part of the challenge for me, to try and still be able to provide some selections that are still not bad bets even when the initial juice has gone out, bearing in mind that quite often they do drift back on Betfair and the other exchanges.
And would you say that's become more difficult as your kind of your profile and your ability to move the markets has become bigger and bigger? I mean, I'm only probably going back five or six years, but I would say certainly watching the markets when your selection goes up, that it jumps even more in price now than it perhaps did 5 or 6 years ago. That's not a scientific... I haven't examined that closely. That's just my instinct. Is that something you've noticed, and has that kind of given you an added pressure?
Possibly. I think you're probably right, yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous the way that they... the speed with which the market moves, and it's obviously a great frustration to me, but there's nothing I can do about it. I do think my tipping has actually improved a little bit over the last 2 or 3 years. Certainly the records suggest that, and that might be why I've had, you know, you're always trying to get better and try and find new ways of being more efficient and find new angles and cut out the errors and that's what keeps you going, is it? The motivation to try and A, keep up with what you've been doing, or B, keep better. But yeah, the you're right. The prices do go very quickly.
And that's something that I think you've got in your Twitter handle. That yes, I have noticed that the prices tend to go quickly. it must be a question you're sick of hearing. Going back to the actual process, your form study process, a few questions. One, going back to we were talking a little bit about the having horse alerts in place. Do you think having where you're sent a race where you might have two or three horses who have been in your alerts, does that actually impact on the way that you would look at a race? Would you frame a race? I mean, would you be looking perhaps to back, you know, an alert horse in a race? Or again, is this something that, because you've become so used to it over the years, it doesn't really impact on the way you frame it?
Well, yeah, the alert horses are my first port of call, because sometimes if I've found something that perhaps other people either don't agree with or haven't found, or it's perhaps a bit more obscure, then that's where I'm most likely to find an overpriced horse that's still going to be there at 9 o'clock, 9:30 the next morning. It's the first port of call, as I say, when I start looking through races for the next day. That's the first thing I look at. It doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, as I say, in the summer, I can get at least 30 alerts a day, and I'm certainly not going to either back or tip all of them.
Yeah, that's fair. In terms of your, one thing I've noticed, and certainly from reading your write-ups that you put up every morning, is that you do seem to use a really wide range of different factors that you incorporate and are willing to use to find a bet. I think that's probably out with the norm. I think probably most people have a slightly more limited set of criteria. But, I mean, I've heard you talk about sectionals, overall time, ground, track, the draw, breeding, stats, trainer records, visual impression, just to name a few. That's clearly suggests that you have an approach to race reading that uses a pretty wide range of different factors. In terms of your form study tools, do you use conventional methods? Do you perhaps have databases? Do you use race form, the Racing Post, time? I mean, you've mentioned you use time form. What different tools do you use to keep track of all these different elements?
Yeah, I use race form, computer race form, and time form. Computer race form is very useful because I store some of my speed figures on it, and I use their database to do certain amounts of research. I know it's perhaps not the trendiest one anymore, but it's just the one that I'm used to, and it suits my needs admirably. Time form, Yeah, I think their race passes are an excellent product. I think they have a very good set of race readers. Probably the biggest compliment I could pay to them is that when I've spotted a horse that I'm interested in, perhaps to put in my alerts or for future, one of the first things I do is check what the time form write-up is and hope that they don't agree with me or don't feel as strongly about it. But generally, they don't miss much at all. There's various other uses for if you've got a horse that you're interested in and you're wanting to check through a race, it's they're a very good way of just making sure whether there are any other danger horses or possible improvers that you might have missed out on. And possibly the other thing I should mention, and arguably the single most valuable use to me of them, is that they provide accurate post-race going descriptions, because I don't think I'm speaking anything particularly original when I say that sometimes the going descriptions as applied to race meetings, including after the event, are not accurate. And I think Timeform are a lot more, they're by far the best way of judging what the going was if you're looking back at a race meeting afterwards, once they've sifted through the times and they've gone through all the different conditions. So yeah, I use both those databases. Just one thing I would say, you were talking about the various different approaches that I use, and you were saying I use quite a wide one. I think it's important to stress, and I can't stress this too highly, really. Although I am, by all intents and purposes, a tipster, it's a tipping column, but it's a tipping column that has an absolute mass readership for just about the biggest horse racing website in the country. And therefore, if you're doing that, I think you've got to be providing more than just a tip or a few tips. You've got to be doing something that's going to get people interested in form study and get people interested in putting their own bets on. And as much as anything, I quite like it when people then move on from reading the column to be putting their own bets on from things they've perhaps derived from the column. And I think you've got to do that if you're working for a really big readership, because with the best will in the world, you can't guarantee that there are going to be prices available all the time. I think you have to provide something a little bit more than just a tip, and that's it. You hope that people can get on it. For me, my remit is much wider than just putting out a couple of tips every day.
Sure. I mean, I guess we talked a little bit about this previously. I guess there is a kind of cognitive dissonance there, in that you have a situation where the people who are probably betting the tips are not probably reading the column, or at least not reading it initially, because they find themselves, in a constant race to get on. Whereas, speaking from my own point of view, I don't really find myself in a situation where I can often bet your selections. But as you kind of highlighted there, I derive value from it, in that, one, it's a good read, but two, it gets me thinking about my own, criteria and thinking a bit more deeply about my methodology in finding a bet. So as you say, you can't really, I suppose, you have a dual importance there, in that, yeah, you've got people who'll bet, I'm sure, quite successfully to the tips, but you've got that other kind of branch where you're providing a different kind of service to people in the form of an interesting and thoughtful read.
Yeah, that's the point I'm making. You can't really compare somebody who's writing a column that's being read by 20,000 people to somebody who's providing an individual tipping service for 30 people or 50 people. They're two completely different disciplines, and I think you just have to have a much broader remit if you are working for a really major tipping organisation, really major horse racing organisation such as the At the Races website.
Yeah, and do you find that the actual process of doing your write-ups, does that perhaps get you thinking more deeply about a selection? Does that actually perhaps influence the bet you find? Perhaps, because I'm sure you'll, by the time you come to write your column, you'll basically have a horse in mind. But have you ever been in a situation where you've started a write-up and thought, oh, perhaps perhaps there's not all the factors that are in its favour that I'd originally thought there was?
Oh, Lord, yes. Lots of times. The number of times that I've started writing the column at, 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning, and I've changed my mind. Quite often it's because of price cuts.
Yeah.
Or there's been earlier price cuts, and I'm thinking it's just about still backable, and then there's a bit more, and I think, no, that's just pushed it over the edge. The number of times where I finish my working day with perhaps a couple of horses in mind the next day, and it's those two horses that I end up tipping, is probably less than 10%. It's really, quite often the horses I'm tipping are probably my seventh, eighth choice from where I was the day before looking through the racing. But that's just something you've got to adapt to, and it's frustrating because quite often you'll write something up and they'll end up winning, and you've just got to be phlegmatic about it and remind yourself of the reasons why you didn't tip them in the first place. You didn't think it was a value price.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of your you seem to have a pretty wide range of races you're willing to work in terms of, you're not really too fussy as to whether it's handicaps or maidens or whatever. That's certainly my read on the situation. Do you have any sort of form of specialisation? Will you look at perhaps handicaps or better quality stuff first, or is it a case of being quite willing to tip in anything, assuming that the price is correct?
In principle, I'm willing to tip in anything. In practice, I would think most of my bets do come in handicaps. I suppose the reason being that if you've found one that you think is a little bit better than its mark, part of the work is done for you, as long as you're sure that none of the others aren't as much in front of their mark or aren't ahead of their mark at all. So, I think one change that's probably made, I probably don't tip as much. I used to tip quite a lot in maidens, and I suspect that's gone down since the novice events were brought in. And I don't know whether that's because they've become a little bit more competitive and I'm less likely to want to risk something that I used to tip a lot of horses that perhaps had one run and had reason to think they might improve. But I probably don't do that as much as I used to do now. I don't tip much in sellers and claimers. Other than that, no. I mean, I tend to... People often comment on the fact that I tend to tip in quite a lot of ordinary low-grade races. And the reason for that is fairly simple. I think it's easier to know something about the horses that the market doesn't know than in, say, a Group 1 race, in the same way that it's easier to know something about a football team in the conference division that the market doesn't know about than it is in Man United v Arsenal or something. So that would be the reason. Also, I tip every day, and on Mondays and Tuesdays, there aren't that many high-quality races anyway. So, in principle, I'm flexible, but most of my selections do seem to come in handicap races.
Because of your... the impact you have on the market, does that play any role? Because obviously there are probably certain type. Well, I mean, there are certain types of races where the market would be able to handle your tips better than, say a Group 1. You would certainly see a shift in price, but it wouldn't be anything like the shift that you would see in, say, a Class 6 handicap. Do you take cognizance of that in the tips you put up, or is it just a case of really... value wherever you can find it?
It tends only to be the really competitive handicaps, the Class 2 heritage handicaps, as they used to be called, or the or group races. And I find it hard enough finding an angle into a lot of group races. Some group races I will, but other than that, most day-to-day racing, perhaps the lower the grade, there is a more significant slashing of the price, but I'm not sure there's a huge amount in it. So I think if I tip within a 0-90 handicap, it's still going to get hammered in price. So I don't think I've got that get out clause really now.
Sure. And in terms of this is going back to the actual your actual selection process. Do you think there are factors which are consistently underrated or perhaps overrated by the market? Do you have like a hierarchy of importance, perhaps?
I think in terms of being underrated by the market, perhaps the most valuable thing is the passage of time, or perhaps more accurate, the passage of another run or two. For instance, if there's a horse that's run well on the all weather, I'm quite happy to see it run on turf next time or even the next couple of times, because you might get more chance of getting a price next time it runs on the all weather if it doesn't reproduce the promise you've shown. Yeah. It's shown. In terms of being overrated by the market, I would say that there's a strong correlation between what racecourse commentators say during the race and how likely a horse is to be over better next time. Okay. If a commentator says, he's running an eye-catching race, or even if it's only quite a mild positive comment in the way that a horse has finished the race, I find that that can still have quite an impact, and those kind of horses I tend not to even put in the tracker, because you just know that they're probably going to open up even shorter than if they'd not had the bad luck in running or whatever it was that was spotted. So off the top of my head, I would say that's the thing that perhaps is most likely to, or if the pundits after the race, because with all the replays and online replays and stuff like that, you can sometimes hear what they say, and if it's picked out by the pundits as well as the commentators, then you're probably not going to get much value, or you're certainly not going to last for long when the market's open next time.
And I assume that would apply to things like racing post spotlight comments, or the time form and running comments, or that kind of thing as well.
Time form in running comments, certainly. I don't know about the Racing Post spotlight comments, but the time form, quite probably actually, yeah, but the ones that time form highlight, quite rightly, get well backed. So, that's why, when I mentioned earlier, the reason when I found a horse with an interesting runner, I do make a point of checking out time form, because, you know, you hope that they haven't form the same opinion as of you, but more often than not, obviously they are going to have done, because they're very good at what they do.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. In terms of video replays, I mean, you mentioned that you would tend to watch them as part of your accumulating time figures. Do you, if you're in a situation where, say, you've got a short list of horses that you're going to be tipping or on the short list to be tipped the next day, would you always make a point of rewatching perhaps recent form video replays for those particular horses? Or is it a case of, because you've watched it previously, you don't really feel that it's necessary to watch it again?
It would depend how clearly it was sort of ingrained in my memory. Sometimes I'll have a horse and I'll already know what it ran for the final sectional, or I'll know that it was unsuited by the gallop because I know what the finishing speed is or something like that, and therefore I possibly don't need to. But generally, yeah, I would watch them again just to make sure that I haven't overreacted. It's funny, because sometimes you'll put a horse in the tracker and it'll run again 3 weeks later, and you'll watch the video and think, why was I so strong on that? And if you can watch the same thing twice and sometimes get a slightly different view. But I suppose that's answering your question, really. That's probably why it's important to try and watch them again. But yeah, I mean, I can't think of any times where I've put a selection up where I haven't watched not just the last video, but two or three recent videos on the day before or on the day I put the column up.
Yeah. Now, going back to what you were saying there about wondering why you'd put a horse in your alert system, I've certainly noticed that as well. And I mean, I don't know if you're the same, but I tend to find myself trusting my present self more than I do my past self, in that if I have a similar situation to yourself, I'm more likely to ignore my view of the horse from 3 weeks ago and trust my present judgment. Is that the same for you?
Yeah, this is Bayesian, isn't it, that we're talking about now? It's all the extra information that you've received in the meantime, perhaps. Yeah, probably, although that's why the beauty of horse alerts is that we can, most of them, you can actually write comments so that you remind yourself, it's not just you get the name coming up, you get the reminder of why you liked it. But, as I say, there's sometimes where I've looked at them when the alerts have come through and thought, right, okay, maybe I over-egged that a little bit. But also, joking aside, there can be extra information coming. You know, other horses from the race may have run since then, and particularly if there's a horse that ran a similar race, you thought that the race didn't suit hold up horses, and a couple that came from the same position of runs of similar circumstances and not really progressed, that might impact your approach as well. So yeah, you've got to be flexible and open-minded and sort of double check your own work, I guess.
Yeah, no, I would again agree with that. In terms of your, and again there was a question about this which kind of adds into the original question I was going to ask, and we've covered it slightly. You tend to be pretty selective, although Tony Keenan, who asked a Twitter question on this, noted that he thought you'd been somewhat less selective and were quite often putting up three or four horses in a day in a way that you perhaps weren't a few months ago. But in terms of your selectivity, is that a limitation, just a result of the limitations on your time, or I think perhaps more likely it's a reflection of the fact that, as you noted earlier, you have seven or eight horses overnight, and come 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock on the morning after, that there's only two or three of them left that are still of the kind of value that you're looking for. Would that be a correct assumption?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. I do have sort of my day mapped out for me, and there's a certain point where I don't really like to go beyond, because I want to be looking, you know, doing my research and looking forward to the next day's racing. I think that's a fair observation. There's been a couple of days where in the last few weeks where I think I've put four up, which is quite unusual for me. And I think in both instances, it was just that there happened to be four that I all liked, and the prices hadn't disappeared on any of them, and I couldn't decide. You know, there weren't two which were much stronger than the other two, so I just thought, what the heck, and probably wrote quite short pieces on all four of them. But I am aware, you know, I do like to, apart from things, I don't like to keep people waiting around, because we have to put them, I feel we have to put the selections up one at a time. I don't feel I can, because the prices go so quick, unless I'm putting a double up, and even that is really difficult for people to try and get on the double. We put them up one at a time, because I think it's unrealistic to expect them to get on three or four unless it's a really strong market like Royal Ascot. So I don't like to keep people waiting around for hours and hours and hours if I can help it. So that's another sort of thing that's in the back of my mind when we're doing the column as well.
And in terms of your rationale for publishing the column when it is published rather than overnight or perhaps closer to race time, is that just because it's a nice mixture of reasonable liquidity and still having prices which are, in your eyes, value?
Kind of, yeah. There's no doubt there's a direct correlation between how early you put the column up and how profitable you're likely to be. And if you can only bet in the 5 minutes before race time, you're probably doing really well to be making. If you're making 5% profit, you're probably a really good judge, or you're getting really good information. But whereas if I were tipping the night before, I'd be disappointed if I couldn't far exceed what my normal ROI is. So yeah, it's a balancing act, and I've got to fit it in. Remember, with the needs of the guys at the races who are uploading the column, because they've got other jobs to do as well. But it kind of suits me. The prices have been up probably around 16 hours by then. So although there are still inefficiencies in the markets by then, the absolute obvious risks have been ironed out. I wouldn't feel comfortable just jumping on prices the moment they come out. I wouldn't really feel that I was achieving much by that, to be honest. But so yeah, it's a kind of a balancing act, but there is a fair amount of work goes into my working day, and I have to physically write the column out, then I have to email it over, then it has to get prepared for uploading, and then we go through the whole Twitter process that you know about. So that is time consuming. If I decide I was going to do it much later and then there was another price change, I'd be even further back with starting my research for the next day, and I do work 7 days a week. So it's kind of in terms of practicalities as much as anything else, that's part of the reason why we put it over that time anyway.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And in terms of, and we talked a little bit about this prior to starting the podcast, the staking plan on the column, it's officially 1 through 5 points, although I would say probably on 90% of occasions, selections tend to be 1 point only. And I myself, and I've only been following the column for a few years, but I can only remember 3 point or possibly 1 4-point selection. What's the... I think the staking plan isn't really yours as much as it's ATR's websites generally. I think it's a staking plan used by all the tipsters on there. But can you just talk a little bit about that and perhaps the occasions where you'd be tipping 2 or 3 point selections, what your rationale for that is?
Yeah, you're correct. It is the ATR tipping format is 1 to 5 points. And when I started back in 2009, I did kind of go along with that, and I would tip 5 point selections and 4 point selections. I tip quite a lot of them. The problem with that is that, well, two things. First of all, it became hard enough to get a reasonable bet on with a 1 point selection. So I'm not sure how realistic it is to start telling people to put five times on, you know, as a 5 point selection. So that's one of the reasons why I stopped doing it. And the other thing is it can kind of distort your results if you get a... I know in the first year, for instance, I put 4 points on at 25-1 on the winner of the Scottish National. That was one of my rare jumps highlights. And that made up 20% of my year's profit, I think. So, and my profits that first year, mate, if you looked at the raw profits, you'd think, oh, that was a good year, but
wasn't
that good at all. You know, it was just because I was tipping 5 points and 4 points, and I don't think it's that. There's plenty about the column that, you know, perhaps people might say isn't realistic, but I think that was definitely one thing that wasn't. So the staking system is, I'll be the first to say, it's a bit of a mess from my point of view, in that by instinct I would tend to want to put the bigger stakes on the ones where I think the price disparity is biggest, but I don't feel comfortable about telling people to put 2 or 3 points on a 25-1 shot. So I probably end up more and more just sort of edging towards, if I do put a 2 point bet on, it's likely to be something at lower odds. Yeah. And it's not something that I would necessarily, I'd probably actually believe quite the opposite. So, you know, I hold my hands up. It's absolutely not the most logical way of doing things, and I haven't really found a good solution to it. And maybe I should just stick to 1 point selections. And I do, you know, I do that largely nowadays. Occasionally, if I do quite fancy something, or I think it's just the wrong price, I might stick a 2 point selection up. But there really isn't a lot of rhyme and reason to it, and I wouldn't necessarily put too much emphasis on it. You know, I wouldn't make a big deal about when I put a 2 point selection up, that's for sure.
I've noticed, and again, this is purely my subjective experience reading the column, but that perhaps the few occasions I've seen you put up a 3 point selection have tended to be both, as you say, shorter prices, but perhaps also in markets where they can handle it better than, I think the most recent one I can remember was it Nathalie's Joy at Ascot was perhaps a 3 point, you can correct me if I'm wrong, 3 point selection, but again that was perhaps in a race where the market wasn't going to be quite as sensitive to your column.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's...
That went well, didn't it? No, she was one who... She bounced back and won next time, although probably not in quite such a good race. And I might have underestimated the tailwind at Goodwood the day she ran. I just thought it was a very quick figure. That was all.
Everybody
that was
with
about.
A stopwatch and, hit that up, I think.
And yeah, and I remember going back and watching it afterwards, and in fact beforehand, and I dismissed the idea. I thought there might have been a bit of a stronger breeze. There were only two races on the straight track that day, as I recall. And, you know, you do some ridiculous things trying to work out what the wind is and during a race. And you're looking at trees and you're looking at the jockey silks and all sorts of starters flag. You hope the starter will stay on the track for all sorts of things you can get really, really insignificant clues from. But, yeah, I've deviated from answering the question. The question was, do I try and put them in stronger markets? Possibly I'm a bit more likely to if I think that. But that ties in as well with putting them on, putting 2-point selections on shorter priced horses, in that the price is less likely to contract as obviously dramatically, if that makes sense. But, you know, I mean, my short price selection still go shorter, but if I put a 2-point selection on a 9-4 shot, you might still get on at 7-4 or something like that. And it's probably my way of saying there's probably a bit of value in this even after the first cut's been made. I don't know, subconsciously, but like I say, I really wouldn't read too much into it, and I'm not far away perhaps from just doing level staking at one point, because it's probably for someone in my position, it's probably the most logical way to go.
Is that as short? I mean, that was, I think, was perhaps, was it 7-4 or something when you put it up? Can you remember tipping horses at a shorter price than that? Can you remember in the early days tipping odds on shots, or is that just something you would swerve away from?
I think in the first year I might have tipped one or two odds on shots. I'm talking 10 to 11, that kind of thing. It's just a shame because people assume that you're doing it because, I don't know why, what people assume you're doing it because, but you get a name for not tipping short priced horses. And the only reason I don't tip short priced horses is because I don't think I'm very good at establishing value on them. Occasionally I'll see something that is 4-6 and I'm pretty sure it should be 1-4, but it doesn't happen very often. And you've also got to bear in mind that a lot of my readers are probably putting fivers and tenners on and probably don't want to be tipped a 4-6 chance anyway. Sure. But in theory, at least, there can be mistakes and errors in pricing and overpriced horses all the way through the price range. It's just that I feel more comfortable. I mean, I feel comfortable. I'm quite happy back in a 6-4 chance if I think it should be 4-6, and I'd have no compunctions about tipping it either. It's just that I seem to find it easier finding 12-1 chances that it should be 6-1 rather than shorter in the market.
And that is about again, I think this comes from a YouTube video I watched. And again, it might have changed in the intervening period, but certainly then I think you mentioned it was around 12-1 was the average price that you tended to put a horse up at.
Yeah, I don't know if that's still the case. I did that. That was certainly true the first 2 or 3 years. The average price might have edged down a little bit, but I'm not sure because I still do put. I like putting the odd 25, 33-1 chance up because that's always how I've bet. Even before I was working in my current job, I've always enjoyed backing big priced horses if I thought that they had a chance of winning and that they were the wrong price. And I don't want, you know, part of when I put those sort of horses up in the column is I'm trying to say to people, you need to look at this end of the market as well. You sometimes can find horses that are 25-1, 33-1 that actually have a real chance, a much better chance than those odds suggest. And for all that, I realise that they tend to get the really draconian price cuts to them. I don't want to give up tipping them because, you know, I think it's part and parcel. It's an important part of the value punter's armoury, finding those really big price horses and occasionally getting a really big payday.
And we'll definitely go into record keeping soon. One question related to that, though, that I've just thought of then. Do you have particular success, would you say? And again, because I know you keep pretty detailed records, do you have particular success with kind of bigger priced selections, or is your ROI pretty uniform across the different prices?
Oh, now, the answer to that is I don't know. If you're asking where's my most profitable area, someone actually sent me an email. This was going back a few years of assessing all my selections across a wide variety of parameters, including trainers, and include one of the ones that they included was price. And I think at the time, probably the sort of 6 to 12 to 1 price range was my most profitable. I don't know if that would still be the case. I haven't tipped as many really big price winners as I would have liked, but I've tipped a few, and it is something that I'd, like I say, I don't really want to give up on that, because I do think that it's possible to find the odd really big price one that actually has a real chance.
Sure. No, I think a couple of kind of quick fire questions. One that I've missed from earlier. In terms of different codes, my instinct is you would prefer the flat and all weather to jumps racing, and you kind of hinted at that when you mentioned one of your, in your own words, your rare successes over jumps in the Scottish Grand National. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes, that's partly because before I did this job, as I mentioned, I'd been a jockey's agent for 5 years, and the jockey I'd worked for, Karen McAvoy, had been obviously a flat jockey, and therefore that was where I'd concentrated all my research and form study. And I think I'm probably slightly better. Well, I definitely think I'm better on the flat than over jumps. There's no question about it. Having said that, if you'd asked me this question 10 to 15 years ago, I would have said I enjoy them both, and I wouldn't have necessarily said I was better at one discipline than the other. It's just that I've concentrated all my time and all my energy on finding angles and learning how to find value bets on the flat, and therefore, you know, it's natural that I'm better at that than over jumps these days.
And do you think, I mean, is it just the fact that jumps adds, kind of takes all the factors that, or well, certainly most of the factors you have on the flat and the all weather, and then adds almost another 3 or 4 layers of whether it's jumping and running style and all these different factors that factoring them in is just, you know, an extra layer of difficulty?
I don't know about that. I used to really enjoy betting over jumps. Before I was working in racing, I used to go to probably as many national hunt meetings as flat meetings. I was always going to Plumpton and Fontwell and Sandown and Kempton Park and lots of other places like that. It's not a preference. I love jumps racing as much as I love flat racing, but I probably find it easier finding angles on the flat and finding horses that are better than the result, which is what it's all about at the end of the day. Yeah. I think that's the top and bottom of it.
Could it even be something as simple as the time involved? Because I noticed that I spend much more time on form study with jumps racing, I think purely because of the time of, you know, it's, races take a minimum of 3.5 minutes and can sometimes last as long as, you know, 8, 9, 10 minutes. Is the time involved in that, given your time is pretty limited, perhaps a factor in itself?
Possibly, but I mean, I tip so few horses over jumps these days anyway. I mean, I make a point of always tipping at Cheltenham, and then on days when there's no flat racing, it's in my contract that I tip every day, so I'll tip at the whichever the jumps racing, unless there's an Irish flat meeting that where I'll find something. But I'd never really considered that actually. But you're probably right. If you are studying jumps form, I suppose it does take that much longer to watch a race. You do, with experience, you can kind of jump to certain points of the race that you might think might be more crucial. I'm not averse to watching some races with one finger on the fast forward button, whilst watching what's happening, and you've got to make sure you don't miss anything, but that you can take shortcuts if you're careful what you're doing. But yeah, I've never really considered about that about jumps racing, to be honest.
Yeah, it's just something I don't know, I almost find it, I guess, because your concentration is being captured for for 3, 4, 5 times as long as it would be over the flat, that I've just found it, yeah, I find it almost more tiring. I don't know if, again, that's, yeah, just my own experience. Moving on to, give me 2 seconds. Yeah, a question I was going to ask, and it kind of relates to what we're talking about with staking plans. With your own betting and perhaps advice for people betting themselves, say prior to doing this column, did you have an approach to staking that was, using your own words, more coherent than the one that you use on the ATR website? Was it a case of betting bigger where there was bigger value, or was it a case of betting bigger where the prices were shorter or whatever? Is there any kind of general advice you could give out with the column?
Definitely the former rather than the latter, where it's possible. Obviously, it's the bigger the prize, the harder it is to get more on. And I think for most people in this day and age, it comes down to getting what you can on when you can. In principle, definitely the more the discrepancy in price between what you think it is and what you think it should be, as long as, you know, you need to take into account, is there a reason why it's a bigger price than I think it should be? Is there something that possibly I don't know, especially if you're looking at the late market on Betfair or something like that? But other than that, generally, the more the bigger the discrepancy in price, the more you'd be trying to get on, really.
Yeah. I noticed on the and again, you mentioned this was pretty out of date, but I noticed on the FAQ, I think the question was in relation to not keeping records at SP. Would you, clearly watching a lot of racing, would you ever come 5 minutes prior to race time, bet perhaps on the exchange if you saw a Rick that was still present?
Would I have a bet on a betting exchange before the race?
Yeah, like in the immediate, because I noticed, the reason I asked that was because I noticed you mentioned, I think, and again, I know these FAQs are out of date, but you would never tend to back anything at SP, but I wondered, given the kind of...
Right, I'm with you. Yeah, what I meant by that was that I wouldn't just leave up a... if I was walking to a betting shop, I wouldn't just
take
SP at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning.
Sorry.
The point I'm making is you should always know what the price of your selection is when you're betting it. That was the point I was making.
Sure.
So yes, I do place bets at Betfair from time to time, 5 minutes before the race or whatever, but you know what price you're getting. What I wouldn't do is place a blind bet when I've no idea what price I'm getting.
Because I've certainly noticed myself that, I guess the way Betfair tends to work, that with your bigger... I've sometimes seen myself and being in a position where I can't really get onto them when they're published, but I would occasionally back your selections, your bigger price selections, where you've maybe put them up at 25 to 1 and they've shortened all the way down to 12s or whatever, but then on Betfair, come race time, they actually end up going off a similar kind of price to the one that you're tipping at. And clearly, from a staking point of view, you'd probably be able to get on more then than you would at 10 in the morning.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Obviously, you need to be aware that the ones that drift back are less likely to win than the ones that enjoy sustained support. And that's true, not just with my selections, but in every case, the market gets generally more and more accurate the closer you get to off time, because the money that's coming in is more informed the nearer the off you get. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are certainly times where maybe the horse doesn't drift all the way back, but without being worryingly weak in the market, it will drift a bit of the way back and perhaps go back to being a value price on Betfair. You know, maybe might not be in the last few minutes, might be earlier in the day. But, you know, you have to pick and choose your moments and decide for yourself whether you think it's an acceptable price or not.
Sure.
But, you know, I'd have to highlight that there's a definite correlation between the horse drifting back out and it not winning, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You know, I'm always happy to, you know, whenever you've backed a horse, you're happy to see it strong in the market just before the off.
Yeah. I've certainly noticed, kind of related to that, your tips seem to see a disproportionate number of non-runners, presumably because you're ruining the price for connections. Have you ever had pissed off trainers or owners send you messages complaining about the fact that you've ruined the price for them?
A couple of times. Yeah, I think of two occasions. I'm sure there's been hundreds more where they haven't. You know, I don't do it deliberately. I'm not completely convinced about the non-runner thing. I'm sure there's a few, but every day I sit down and quite often I start writing up columns and I'm halfway through writing it up and the horse is pulled out as a non-runner.
Yeah.
And people often say it's just after I've tipped the column, but most non-runners come out between about 8:30 and about 10 o'clock in the morning or a large percentage of them anyway, which happens to be about the time I'm doing my column. I'm not setting out to upset owners, but, you know, it's the bane of my life as much as anybody else's, the fact that the price has disappeared so quickly. I own racehorses, part own certainly loads and loads of racehorses, and I've got to be honest, I've never really seen it as my prerogative to have first shot at the prices on those. I think there are the way that owners are recompensed in terms of prize money has for a long time left plenty to be desired, but I don't necessarily think that we as owners have a right to be recompensed in that way by having special treatment in the betting market. But, you know, I'm not, you know, obviously I regret it if there's people, I regret all the prices that get. I wish none of them ever got cut, but unfortunately that's the situation we're stuck with.
Do you, I mean, again, this might not be something you would keep a record of, but does your tipping of a horse reverberate beyond the immediate race, i.e. even if the horse perhaps underperforms when you've tipped it, do you think see it being a shorter price next time out because you've seen something in it that you thought, you know, was worth backing in that particular race?
I think it depends on how it ran. If it was unlucky and I tipped it the time before, I think perhaps it might be more likely to be well back next time, certainly in the early markets, you know, when the prices come out the night before and stuff like that. Other than that, I probably wouldn't say so, I don't think. I quite often get people sometimes come on Twitter and say, do you not fancy such and such today? And I start thinking, well, why would they say that? And then I remember I actually tipped it before and in a completely different race where it might not have run very well, or it might have run very well, but it's a third of the price today. I don't think there aren't that many horses that I tip and tip and tip over again, because either the cat's out of the bag or they're disappointed. So there's some horses that I tipped one the other day at Bath that I've tipped twice this year, but I don't think there's that many that I tip over and over and over again.
And I guess that's probably for that very reason, and that, yeah, if you're tipping something up that, you know, regardless of whether it runs well, it may well be artificially short the next time you approach that race.
Partly. I also do have it in the back of my mind, to be honest, that I don't really want to tip the same owner's horse three times in a row or something like that, you know. And there's not, you know, it's probably not, that's me only paying lip service to that situation, really. But there have certainly been times where I've shied away from tipping a horse because I've suddenly realised I've tipped three from the same stable in that week or something, and you know, I really don't want to start tipping another one from that yard. So, but no, there aren't that many horses where I keep going back to the same horse over and over.
Yeah, I'm conscious of your time, but there's a few more questions that are most of which are fairly short and sweet that I'll keep firing at you, if that's okay.
Sure, that's fine. Yeah.
One person asked, and this is slightly slightly mischievous, asked if there was a WhatsApp. He said there was a WhatsApp group where you put the selections out early, and that was the reason the prices go so quickly. I don't know if that's something you want to comment on.
That's a really funny idea, that, isn't it? Because I mean, apart from anything else, if I were putting selections out to a WhatsApp group before the column went online, and the same small group of people were backing them every day, what do you think the bookmakers would do? What do you think they would? What do you think would happen to the prices? The prices would go across the board before the column went up, and I mean before, you know, not 30 seconds or 10 seconds or whatever it is after. They'd go across the line. I'd be shooting myself in the foot, even if I, you know, there's no way I'd ever do that. That's, no, sorry, wrong.
In terms of your approach to analysing, and this is kind of coming on to your post-race analysis, one fairly, or in some people's view, very reliable guide of success would be whether they're consistently beating SP or Betfair SP. In your case, that's not really an appropriate barometer given the impact you have on markets. Are you really just judging your performance on the success of the column, the profits of the column, or are you still in a situation where if you've put up a couple of horses of a day, you'll look at quite deeply at their runs and perhaps where you've gone wrong or where things have gone right or perhaps reasons for why they haven't performed in the way that you maybe expected them to?
Well, couple of points here. First of all, in terms of how I judge the success of the column, it has to go beyond just the profit and loss,
sure,
because
course, yeah.
Not everybody can get on. And as I've said earlier, the aims, if you look at the FAQ, I've never put in the FAQ, the aims are to make people a solid profit or whatever. It says something like the aims are to provide an interesting read, give people a chance of backing a decent price winner, and to get them interested in form study, to make people realise that it is possible through hard work and through finding angles to make a profit at horse racing, assuming you can get bets on. On a minor note, you mentioned Betfair SP. The column is actually up to Betfair SP this year. It was up a tiny amount to Betfair SP last year, and the year before that, it was up about 100 points to Betfair SP. So I do think there are still ways of using the tips and making a profit if you're judicious in terms of, even if you can't get on at the opening prices, that, you know, you can still strike some value bets, I think, on the selections. But no, the aim, I can't emphasize this more strongly, the aim of the column has to be, and is much broader than just being about the tipping and about the profits, or, you know, whether you see them as mythical profits or whatever.
Sure.
The aim is much more about, it's a widely read column on a huge horse racing website, and the aim is to get people interested in betting on horse racing, from my point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that, and this wasn't actually the question I was going to ask you next, but it perhaps leads into this question, which is, given you're, by any objective metric, one of the best minds in the game, is that a big part of your rationale for continuing to work for At the Races and continue to do this publicly rather than perhaps going private and running your own service, where I'm sure financially you could do even better, but it might not give you know the same satisfaction in that sense?
Oh, yeah. If I went private, I'd have to be very restrictive in the number of clients I had, and I'd probably have to charge them quite a lot of money to, you know, if you talk about it. I'm not particularly, I know it's an easy thing to say, but I'm really not particularly motivated by money at all. if I were going private as well, it'd be a fairly soulless transaction from my point of view in terms of just giving out a tip, because you know, I enjoy the writing the column and the reasoning behind it, and that's, I suppose you could still do that. In fact, I'm sure lots of, it's probably an erroneous thing I've said, because I'm sure lots of tipsters do that as well, but I wouldn't feel comfortable. I like writing for a large audience, and as I say, trying to get people interested in horse racing and betting on horse racing, and I'd feel I wasn't achieving that if I was just at a very, very small audience who, you know, my duties really were to be turning a profit for them. So, no, it's never really held any appeal at all in that respect. And the other thing is, as well, at the races, my boss, Matthew Taylor, is somebody who I get on very well with, and I don't think we've ever had a crossword all the time I've been working for him, and that's really important. And, you know, I've got a job that thousands of people would give their right arm to have, and you know, I'm very, very lucky to have the job that I have. I'm paid to study form and come up with tips, and you know, I don't see the grass as being greener anywhere else, really. You know, it's a job that I still get out of bed and look forward to doing every day.
And I guess the fact you're because I'm sure given your ability, if you wanted to be in a situation where you were only working 5 days a week, say, that you could go down that route. But I mean, I think the fact you tip 7 days a week is indicative of the fact you still get an amount, you know, a real enjoyment out of the whole process.
Yeah, it's not really a job, is it? It's not. I mean, the job I did before I went into horse racing was quite a genuinely stressful job, and you needed, I mean, I need holidays in this job now for sure. And you know, there are times each year where I'm ready for a break. I normally do quite a long stint from the spring to the summer without a day off, basically, and then I'm ready for a break. And no, it's a labour of love, and it's you know, I don't get out of bed in the morning and think, oh gosh, I've got to go down and find another couple of selections. It's, you know, like I say, I'm really lucky to be able to do what I do and get paid for it.
Yeah. Few other quick questions. One thing you were keen to emphasise that I hadn't flagged as a potential question prior to this was the importance of record keeping. I guess both in for yourself, but also as kind of advice for other people looking to have a real go at betting successfully. Is that something you want to touch on briefly?
Yeah, I just think I think it's important to be honest with yourself in terms of I used to keep records before I worked for At the Races, and I don't think I did for the first couple of months. I kept records, but I don't think we published them. And then a couple of people mentioned to me that, you know, oh, have you not got any records? And I had a chat with my boss, and I said, you know, I think we really ought to keep records as selections. And he was a bit unsure about it, and he said, well, you do know that if you start doing it, you've got to keep doing it. You can't stop, you know, if things go wrong. And I said, fine, that's fine. And we've kept records ever since. And, you know, to me, it's important to have all the records of all the horses, the prices you've put up, to make sure that you've included Rule 4 deductions and stuff like that, and that people can see exactly where your records are. And another reason why that's important is that people think that if you're a successful punter or tipster, if you're a winning punter, you win all the time. It's one of the biggest mistakes or misconceptions that people have. And if you look down my records, and every tip that I've ever made on the At the Races website is there, you can see that there are many, many chunky periods where I was absolutely awful for a few weeks. And that's what happens. And that's what happens with, you know, most pro punters will tell you the same thing, that even though they're long-term winners, it doesn't mean they win all the time. And I think, I wish more people would actually look at the records and see just how bad I've been some of the time, because that's an actual natural reflection of what happens, the ebb and flow of being a punter. And it's just one of the most important lessons to learn, that you can be a winning punter, but that doesn't mean that you win all the time.
Yeah. And in relation to that, and again, this kind of question leads on quite nicely. Would you attribute that purely to variance, or would you say there are situations where you've noticed your edge dwindling? I know the results certainly wouldn't suggest that, but have you ever altered your process or tweaked it slightly during a bad run that's kind of brought things back up to scratch? Or are there perhaps factors that you've realised the market's now overly aware of that you've eliminated from your process, anything like that?
I don't think I've tweaked my approach during a bad run, because I'd always take the approach, unless it really lasted for a long time, that it was just variance, and I'd expect 2 or 3 really bad runs each year anyway. Let me think. In terms of changing my approach, yes, there are certainly some angles that I used to use that I don't use so much anymore because the market's caught up with them. I also think sometimes I'm thinking more. I used to say that I didn't really believe in form for a tipster, and I'm kind of changed my opinion on that, in that there are times now where I feel I'm more on top of things. And I'll give you an example. When I take a week off work, and I did that in August most recently, I find when I come back that I'm immediately so far behind with all the stuff, the day-to-day stuff that I do to keep up with the form, that I think it does have an impact. It might not be obvious to people reading the column, but I do think it can have an impact when I take a period away from work. And so yeah, that's one thing that can have an impact. And definitely, I've changed my approach. If you went back and read some of the columns I was doing 7 or 8 years ago, they probably read quite differently to what I'm doing now. And it's quite possible that in another 2 or 3 years, I might be, I might have to have moved on. There's certainly some of the angles I've used on the all weather are definitely being factored more into the market from an early stage, by which I mean, the night before, which perhaps wasn't the case 2 or 3 years ago. So you do have to constantly be on your toes and trying to keep up to pace with that sort of thing and find new ways of finding value, I guess.
Yeah. Two more questions. The first is, I mean, you're clearly, by any metric, successful. Your ATR is lead tipster, and by your own admission, you're doing a job that you love. Is there anything else within racing that you'd like to do, like to achieve? I know you've dipped your toe into ownership with, I think, Raising Sands was one of them, and a few other horses. Is there anything that you still feel that you've yet to, a goal that you've yet to reach?
No, you're right. I've enjoyed most of the horses. I'm quite friendly with a guy called Nick Bradley, who's he's got his own racing syndicates now, Nick Bradley Racing, and we talk a lot about horses, and we discuss before the big sales. We each draw up our own lists and share notes, and if quite often, I mean, Nick buys a lot of horses. He's got loads and loads of horses in training with different trainers that he has his syndicates of. But I normally have shares in 3, 4, 5 at a time, and I really enjoy that. That's sort of kind of an outlet within horse racing that isn't to do with my tipping. I can't think of anything else really that I'd want to do inside the sport other than that. As I say, I've got the job I want at the moment, really, so I don't really think there's any other particular ambitions I've got.
But that must be satisfying in itself, the fact that as you say, you really are doing something that to you isn't work. You're getting up and, yeah, you're looking forward to the day in a way, I guess, that most people aren't.
Well, there's new puzzles and new challenges every day, and I'm challenging myself as well to try and maintain previous records and improve on them if I can. And that's an ongoing motivation as well. But yeah, I mean, as I keep saying, I'm really, really fortunate to have the job I have. Lots and lots of people would love to have that kind of a job. And, I'm just the guy in the hot seat at the moment, and I'm enjoying every minute of it.
Yeah, no, that's great. And finally, because this is a betting related podcast, and I think people perhaps tend to not associate you with betting as much as they do with tipping, but I'm sure you must have had a particularly bad beat or a particularly large win story that's worth sharing. I don't know if that's something you want to touch on.
In all honesty, I don't think I do, really. I've not... I can remember when... I tipped and backed Monty's Pass when he won the Grand National. At the time, I had quite a big bet on that, and that was... At the time, I think that was my biggest win. But because of the limits to the amounts you can get on horses, most of my biggest wins are all pretty much about the same amount, I think. So there isn't necessarily one that particularly stands out in that way. It's just a question of keeping on chipping away and keeping on trying to win money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, just want to say thanks very much for coming on. I mean, we've done 4 or 5 of these podcasts, and the metric I use for success is generally, you know, do I feel I've learned something, and do I feel that we've covered topics that I think other people, you know, who are perhaps aspirational bettors would find valuable, and I absolutely think we've done that. So really appreciate you taking the time to come on, and if there's anything we've missed, and if I can ever twist your arm to do it again, it would be great to have you on sometime again in the future.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thank you to everyone who's listened, and I hope there's been something interesting in it, and thank you for having me.
Excellent. Thanks very much. I'll hopefully have a podcast for you guys next week.